Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Leah Bulger, retired U.S. Navy commander and current president of Veterans for Peace, who assesses the danger of a new war being launched against Iran before the November U.S. election. Dan Doyle, a family physician from Fayette County, West Virginia, who talks about the deep divisions among neighbors in Appalachia over the issue of mountaintop removal coal mining. And Leonard Iger, a spokesperson with the Plowshares Movement, who talks about the message delivered by three activists when they staged a protest at the U.S. government's weapons-grade uranium storage facility in Oak Ridge, Tennessee. But first we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
Simmering tensions over territory and oil resources in the South China Sea resurfaced as China lectured U.S. diplomat Robert Wang over the U.S. State Department's criticism of China for its raising the administrative status of Shansha, an island in the disputed territory, and setting up a new military garrison in the South China Sea. Recent talks by the Association of Southeast Asia Nations, ASEAN, broke down over a disputed code of conduct for the South China Sea, a key shipping lane carrying over $5 billion in trade each year. Asian security analysts say hardliners in China have driven recent moves in the South China Sea over their fear of a growing U.S. military presence in Southeast Asia. China's hawks also charge that the U.S. is behind territorial claims by Vietnam and the Philippines, challenging China's authority in the region. The state-run People's Daily newspaper also asserts that China's core interests are at stake in the South China Sea, similar to the nation's claims in Tibet and Xinjiang in western China. The International Crisis Group's Stephanie Klein-Albrandt observed, "Energy exploration in these disputed waters will lead to more diplomatic rows and possibly skirmishes between surveying and law enforcement vessels of opposing claimants." For decades, Bolivia's coca growers resisted drug eradication campaigns funded by the U.S. Drug Enforcement Administration, which had sparked violence. Coca farmers won a significant victory in 2004 when they won the right to grow small family plots of coca. In 2009, Bolivia expelled the DEA and became the only South American country to pull out of the United Nations Convention on Narcotic Drugs. Bolivian President Evo Morales set a new path on drug policy by working with coca unions to set strict limits on coca production and looking to develop new legal uses for coca. At the same time, Bolivia established new partnerships with the European Union and Brazil to support limited coca production as an alternative to the United States' zero-tolerance approach. A hemispheric shift occurred in 2009 when the former presidents of Mexico, Brazil, and Colombia concluded that the 40-year war on drugs was a failure, and a shift was needed from repression to prevention. In the aftermath of the April Organization of American States summit in Colombia, Uruguay's President José Mujica called for establishing a legal marijuana marketplace with the drug grown and distributed under state supervision. Across Latin America, courts have upheld the right to use small amounts of drugs for personal use. Colombia's Constitutional Court recently upheld a law decriminalizing the personal consumption of marijuana and cocaine. The Center for Public Integrity reports the two top Republican super PACs, Mitt Romney's fund Restore Our Future and American Crossroads, co-founded by Karl Rove, have raised over $24 million from corporations for the 2012 campaign. Top donors to the super PACs included hedge funds, coal companies, for-profit colleges, and dietary supplement companies. In contrast, corporations have donated only 5% of the funds raised by the Democrat super PACs. Priorities USA Action, Majority PAC, House Majority PAC, and American Brigade 21st Century, who by June the 30th collectively raised $48 million. Super PACs rose in prominence after the 2010 Citizens United Supreme Court decision, which allowed unlimited individual, corporate, or union donations to independent campaigns. Ironically, in 2010, super PACs were outspent by politically focused 501c4 non-profit organizations. Because these groups claim to be engaged in educational, not political activity, by law they do not have to disclose their donors, a requirement that super PACs, candidates and political parties must abide by. New York State Attorney General Eric Schneiderman is now investigating groups like American Crossroads and has requested tax returns and financial records. Election campaign finance reformers like Craig Holman of Public Citizen say corporations use campaign contributions to diminish the regulatory regimes that govern their industries. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Nigel Victor Rees.
As the November 6th U.S. presidential and congressional election approaches, speculation is running high that Israel may view the next 3 months as the best time to initiate an airstrike targeting Iran's nuclear research facilities. For years now, the U.S., Israel, and NATO member nations have ratcheted up pressure on the Islamic Republic to halt its enrichment of uranium and other research that Western nations charge is part of Iran's goal of building nuclear weapons capability. Iran has long maintained that their uranium enrichment program is designed solely for civilian energy purposes. Israeli officials, well aware that President Obama is vulnerable to Republican Party charges of being soft in Iran in the period before the election, feel that if they initiate an attack, the White House could be pressured to provide military support for an Israeli airstrike. If, on the other hand, there is no airstrike and Obama is reelected, Israeli leaders express concern that the U.S. may be less likely to support an attack on Iran and exert pressure on Israel to make concessions on future negotiations with the Palestinians. But many observers believe that President Obama is anxious to avoid being drawn into a new conflict with Iran before the election, as evidenced by his decision to dispatch 5 senior officials, including Secretary of State Hillary Clinton and Defense Secretary Leon Panetta, to visit Israel and urge more time for sanctions to take effect and bring Iran back to serious negotiations. But inside Israel, there is growing speculation in the media that the Israeli military is now preparing to launch an attack against Iran with or without the U.S. Your reporter spoke with Leah Bolger, retired U.S. Navy commander and current president of Veterans for Peace, who assesses the danger of a new war being launched against Iran before the U.S. November election.
Some time ago, back in the spring, Veterans for Peace issued a statement imploring President Obama. This was when Netanyahu was in the country at the AIPAC convention. And we besieged President Obama to declare very unequivocally that he would not support, the U.S. would not support a military attack by Israel on Iran. If President Obama is silent and does not say we will not support Israel, then his silence will be interpreted by Netanyahu as a court that he is in agreement. It seems very dire. I know in the spring it seemed like we were hearing more and more vocalization about actual words of a threatening, and that you heard a lot more talk about this threat. We will not allow this to happen, and very bellicose and confrontational words. And then it sort of died down a little bit with, you know, the presidential elections have taken over the news cycle completely, and now you don't hear so much talk about it. But I'm very worried that Israel can do whatever they want because they know that both sides, the Republicans and the Democrats, rely so heavily on AIPAC for their financing that they sort of do AIPAC's bidding. And it's very frightening. And it's critical that we speak up as a community, as a global community, in opposition to these bellicose threats of war.
What is your biggest concern if Israel should decide to attack Iran's nuclear research facilities with or without the United States? What are the potential flashpoints that could follow such an attack?
Well, if Iran is attacked, I think their natural reaction then would be to close the Straits of Hormuz. Gas and oil would skyrocket. If people think gasoline is expensive now, that would be a huge, it would be a real shock to American people. If Israel does this, you know, the United States has pledged, and Mitt Romney has fallen all over himself to almost urging Israel to kind of take the lead on this. So I think the only hope we have is if Obama says clearly, we will not follow you into a war. Iran is a signatory to the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty, the NPT. Iran is a signatory. Iran has invited IAEA inspectors into its country to look at its facilities. Yet its neighbor, Israel, does not even admit that they have nuclear weapons, and it is well known that they have several hundred nuclear weapons. IAEA has never inspected them. Israel is not a signatory to the NPT, and neither are India or Pakistan, also nuclear powers in the region. So Iran is completely surrounded by countries with nuclear weapons. So if they are told, you know, they are attacked, I think they will strike back with whatever tools they have, and oil is one that they can use against us. It would be disastrous for Israel to do that, and it would be disastrous for the United States to follow them into that.
With this issue of many in Congress, the politicians in Israel advocating military action against Iran, it's important to gauge American political opinion here, especially in an election year. Where do you think American public opinion comes down in terms of new military action, whether it's against Iran, with Israel, or to intervene in this rebellion that's been going on for 18 months in Syria?
I think the American public does not want another war. I mean, they have said clearly and for some time now that they want us out of Afghanistan. They wanted us out of Iraq. And I don't believe that the American people want another war. But the Congress and the people who make the decisions don't listen to the American people's will. They listen to the corporate will. And there is a lot of money to be made in continuous war, which is why I believe that it's going to be very, very difficult to end war, because it's this perpetual cycle of we, meaning the government, has to use our weapons so that we can create more, so that we can keep the machine rolling along. The people who are knowledgeable and read and understand what's going on are very alarmed. The vast majority of the American people don't know what's going on out of lack of curiosity or lack of access to real news and real facts. You know, we have to start thinking of the lives of people in other countries as being equally valuable as lives of Americans, and that's the bottom line. And we have to start thinking about the innocent people who are being harmed by our government's policies, and I think that's what it comes down to. The American public needs to wake up.
That was Leah Bolger, president of Veterans for Peace, who spent 20 years on active duty in the U.S. Navy, retiring in 2000 at the rank of commander. Find more analysis of a possible conflict with Iran on our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. Tensions are rising in the coalfields of southern Appalachia as more militant, though nonviolent, protests are being staged to end mountaintop removal coal mining, as the demand for coal and its availability in the region is declining. In West Virginia, even some pro-coal officials estimate that the coal industry will play out in the state over the next 20 years, although vast amounts will remain accessible in the American West for much longer. In mountaintop removal coal mining, mountain ridges are blown up using millions of tons of dynamite, and the dislodged rocks and earth are dumped into the valleys below. The process so far has obliterated 500 mountain ridges and buried 2,000 miles of freshwater streams. Dan Doyle is a family physician who's worked at the New River Health Association serving Fayette County, West Virginia, for the past 34 years. He also directs the health center's Black Lung Clinic. Over the past several years, underground coal miners have seen a spike in black lung disease, which restricts breathing and in the most serious cases is fatal. Doyle notes that several recent studies have revealed a marked increase in both birth defects and certain cancers in residents of communities near mountaintop removal sites. His patients include many residents who depend on the coal industry for their livelihood. Sitting on the front porch of his home, Dr. Doyle spoke with Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhus, sharing his views about the complicated nature of community support for and opposition to mountaintop removal coal mining.
The people most opposed to mountaintop mining here in Fayette County tend to be people who are middle class, came from outside, are first generation here, have college education, often have professional jobs, or are employed often as owners and entrepreneurs in the tourism industry. So they have a economic interest against mountaintop mining. And then in addition, they tend to be environmentally aware and have kind of a global perspective on climate change and on environmental destruction in general. Then there's the probably majority of the population here whose families have been here for a long time, many of whom are employed directly in the coal mining industry, not just as coal miners, because those jobs have shrunk to a handful, but there's so many other jobs that are related: equipment shops, supplies, electrical equipment, maintenance, tires, fuel, insurance, that the coal and gas industry here is so pervasive in our economy that there are many, many people, and they tend to be more people who are natives and have been here for a long time and who are working class or below, who very strongly identify with coal mining, both as what's putting bread on the table in somebody's family, in their extended family right now, and also that it's their history and their heritage. And so that difference has been easy to exploit for the energy industry and the coal mining industry. And they've done a great job of keeping people divided, keeping people at each other's throats, keeping people blaming each other and hating each other. And it's a really big challenge here.
I've read that a number of polls over the last, I'm not sure what number of years, show that overall, statewide, more people are opposed to mountaintop removal mining than in favor. But when you get right in southern West Virginia, it may not be so, maybe less than majority.
There's a wonderful way to appreciate that around here, because all you have to do is look at all the Friends of Coal decals on people's cars and trucks. And if you start looking, I'm assuming you've seen some of those. If you start looking, Friends of Coal is basically a coal operator, Republican lobby and media campaign that is aimed at maintaining mountaintop mining with minimal restriction and minimal interference as long as possible. They know the handwriting's on the wall. They know that this can't continue. My analogy is somebody who's won a prize where they get 15 minutes in a grocery store to run around and put as much stuff in their cart as they can. And they get in there, they go straight to the meat department, and they just load their cart up with meat and just throw in liquor, and they're on the clock, and they're going to get everything they can until the whistle blows. And so the Friends of Coal campaign is to do everything possible to extend that by a few years so that they can cram as much coal wealth and energy wealth into their carts before finally it comes to a stop. But they have succeeded in getting people with that coal mining history and legacy and who are depending on that for this month's food and this month's college tuition for their children and this month's car payment to join with that. In addition, those stickers are handed out at work at union and non-union mines and equipment shops and electrical supply shops and barber shops. And people are basically told, show your support, put this on your car. And if you're a coal miner at a non-union mine and your boss tells you to put this on your car, you put it on your car and you take it home and tell your wife to put it on her car. And so you see this stuff all over the place. That's one way that it's easy to see, if not active, thoughtful support, gut support and identification with this anti-government, anti-EPA, anti-regulation, anti-inspection, pro-corporate, anti-union cause. It's actually quite a big paradox and contradiction that that is the case, but it is.
That was Dr. Dan Doyle of New River Health Association. Visit our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org to learn more about mountaintop removal coal mining's impact on surrounding communities. On July 28th, three activists with the anti-nuclear weapons plowshares movement entered the U.S. government's Y-12 Oak Ridge, Tennessee National Security Complex, where weapons-grade uranium is stored for America's nuclear weapons arsenal.
The same facility that provided the uranium to make the first atomic bomb exploded over Hiroshima, Japan, on August 6, 1945. After entering the security zone, Megan Rice, an 82-year-old Roman Catholic nun, Michael Wally, 63, and Greg Obed, 57, hung banners, spray-painted anti-nuclear slogans on buildings, and symbolically poured their own blood on the structures housing the uranium. The three members of the protest action, that they dubbed Transform Now Plowshares, were arrested and now face up to 16 years in jail and $600,000 in fines. While the media coverage of the nonviolent civil disobedience protest focused almost solely on the security breach at the top-secret weapons facility, the activists, part of the religiously-based Plowshares movement launched in 1980 by the Berrigan brothers and other Catholic activists, were determined to draw attention instead to what they see as the illegality and immorality of these horrific weapons and our nation's continuing pursuit of them. Your reporter spoke with Leonard Iger, a spokesperson with the Plowshares movement, who talks about the message delivered by these three activists when they conducted their protest action at the Oak Ridge nuclear facility.
Basically, they went in, you know, in the dark of night with their hammers, their blood, their own blood, and I'll explain that in a moment, banners, and spray paint. And all of these things have very important symbolic meaning from a spiritual, religious standpoint. And they were able to penetrate four different fences into the high security area surrounding the building. They're the highly enriched uranium materials facility. Got right up to the wall there and spray-painted messages of swords to plowshares among them, hammered on the walls, spilled their own blood. And these things are all symbolic. For one thing, the direct message of, which comes from the Hebrew Bible, Isaiah, admonishing the nations to stop making war against nations and turn their swords into plowshares, their weapons into something that is life-giving. And then their blood, having great symbolism that they are willing to shed their blood to save the lives of others, to prevent others from dying. A hammer, the hammer meaning the ability to hammer the swords into plowshares. So all these things have very important symbolic meaning in what they were trying to do in stating their message. But beyond that, each of these individuals knew what the consequences will be. They know that they're going to go to court, and their hope is, as is every Plowshares case, to be able to speak on the public record, to speak before a judge and a jury, and to speak on the things that they believe are important, that our nation is not living up to its obligations under treaty law, the Non-Proliferation Treaty, international humanitarian law, even the basic laws of war that our military is bound in their engagement in war. So there are a number of issues that they believe our nation is not living up to. So their hope is that they will be able to speak to those things. That, in other words, they feel that what they did is not illegal, but they are trying to speak out, in a sense, based on the Nuremberg principles, speak out on something that is immoral and illegal by our government in terms of the continuing threat or use of nuclear weapons.
Since 9/11, the country has been focused on terrorism, the wars that were first initiated against Afghanistan and then Iraq. And with the demise of the Soviet Union in the 90s, focus on nuclear weapons in terms of anti-nuclear weapons movement has diminished quite a bit. And the public attention is not drawn to the dangers of nuclear war as it once was. What drives the urgency of those who are active in the Plowshares movement?
Excellent question. Ironically, with the end of the Cold War, everyone just assumed that all was well, that the nuclear danger had passed, and the weapons would be done away with. It went out of mind. It was always out of sight, but it went off the radar. And in fact, both the United States and Russia continued to maintain the weapons and deploy weapons, not to the same degree that was done during the Cold War, but to this day, we still maintain our weapons on alert status. They are on a launch-on-warning status, and that means that the president, if his advisors come to him and say, you know, we believe there are missiles incoming, he has a very drastic decision to make. And there are any number of accidents that could occur and that historically have been documented incidents in which weapons could have been launched. And so that's a great concern. The fact that we have not cut back our deployed weapons to any real degree. There's been a great deal of rhetoric, but right now Trident submarines are patrolling the seas, and each of them carry 24 missiles, at least four warheads currently, each one over eight times the explosive force of the Hiroshima weapon. And each one is enough to destroy more than a continent and to cause a global disaster. So the point being that we are still deploying the weapons, and beyond that, we're rebuilding our nuclear weapons infrastructure. I think that's something key, and why Sister Megan and company picked this Y-12 facility. That building, the highly enriched uranium materials facility, is fairly new. It was finished in 2008, cost over $500 million, and that is one of many facilities, including Kansas City. The Kansas City bomb plant is being rebuilt even as we speak. Los Alamos is planning a whole new plutonium pit facility. Many facilities being rebuilt. And then, to cap it off, the Navy plans 12 new ballistic missile submarines to replace the Trident fleet that would operate till the year 2082. And these activities and plans send a clear message that we are going to continue to deploy and threaten to use nuclear weapons. And as someone who's worked in risk assessment and public health, I can tell you that there is no such thing as absolute safety. Sooner or later, accidents occur. And sooner or later, if these weapons continue to be deployed for any more decades, sooner or later, something's going to happen. And these Plowshares activists dearly want to create a world free of nuclear weapons for future generations. They want to create a sustainable, safe world where people can live and resolve conflicts nonviolently and not have to live under the threat of the effects of a nuclear war, which would be devastating to not only one isolated area where that war might occur, but to the globe. You don't isolate the effects of a nuclear war.
That was Leonard Iger, Media and Outreach Coordinator with Disarm Now Plowshares. Find links to more information on the Transform Now Plowshares Oak Ridge protest action by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archive programs in MP3 and streaming audio. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Twitter at BTL Radio News. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Hank Hoffman, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Nigel Victor Reese, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.